All right. So good evening and welcome, everyone, to the seven principles of Shalom Bayis. A few words of introduction before we get going. Number one, first and foremost, just a handful of thank yous. I don't think it's appropriate to give a talk on Shalom Bayis without thanking one spouse. So I want to thank my wonderful wife for providing the backdrop and the atmosphere in which all of these thoughts and ideas could be tried and could be tested and we could perfect together. But that really is an important thank you because, and this is another important point of introduction, which is that there's always this almost unspoken sort of suggestion whenever you're presenting and whenever you are delivering any sort of material that somehow or another the person at the front of the room must be the professional and all the people who are sitting in the back of the room must be completely lacking in know-how. And nothing could be further from the truth. We are all in this together. This is something that requires a great deal of ongoing tinkering, which is really the point of this entire series. The idea here is not to suggest that that anybody who is in this room, oh, things are just dire and we don't know what to do and we're at a very, very scary place. Chas v'shalom. The idea of Shalom Bayis is that it's something that needs to be not just managed, and we'll get to that in a second, but it needs to be something that is developed and that we think about constantly. As I wrote in the email this morning, it is one of our most prized assets. It is perhaps our most valuable asset, and it's something that very much needs to be managed, and we need to maintain, and we need to upgrade whenever we have the opportunity to do so. So very important thank you. I think it's also worthwhile, by the way, and I just want to make this point very, very briefly. I think I want to also give a shout-out to both my parents and my in-laws for being wonderful role models, really, for Shalom Bayis. And I think that's something that we probably don't take stock of often enough, that when we speak about the relationship that we have with our spouses, it's not simply a relationship that begins and ends there, but this is absolutely the greatest gift that we could also then present to our children, to be able to give them a model and a template for what it means to have a healthy and a successful and a sustainable marriage and give them some of the tools of the trade, even if only through osmosis, as to how it is that they're supposed to develop, hopefully, in their own lives. I also want to give a very, very special thank you and a very meaningful thank you to my friend Moshe Raskind, who, if I'm not the professional, then having a professional sort of in my corner was very helpful in preparing and enriching these shiurim, and hopefully that's going to be an ongoing conversation. So thank you very much for all of the backdrop and all the context to help frame out so much of this material. I think it's worth noting that, of course, this series is predicated on a book that I meant to bring with me, and I don't see it, but it is The Seven Principles of Making Marriage Work by Dr. John Gottman. So why did I come upon this book? There is a whole world of, I don't know, call it self-help material or research or pop psychology when it comes to marital advice. How did I come at this one? So this is actually based upon another principle, which really oftentimes guided my dating life. And this is not going to get awkward. But I had a basic rule of thumb when I was dating, which was that if you hear a suggestion, not just once, but twice, and then maybe even three times, that might be a very good idea. So meaning somebody says, hey, I have an idea. Why don't you, I know this girl, and why don't you try it out? Why don't you go out? I think you guys would like each other. Tell me about her. No, I really don't think so. I'm just not seeing it, and I'm busy, and I don't think so. And then somebody else, another friend, or relative, or whomever, well-wisher, suggests it. I don't think so. And then you hear it a third time, and you start to feel like maybe there's some substance to it. Which, by the way, never actually panned out for me personally, but I still think that it's a very worthwhile principle, and that takes us to this particular book. That, it's something that kept on just floating to the surface, and when other people and other authors and other rabbis that I respect very, very much kept on mentioning the name John Gottman and also this book in particular, it really floats to the surface. So when you see that, it's Malcolm Gladwell is referencing it, and Rabbi Ephraim Goldberg is referencing it, and Arthur Brooks is referencing it, and all these other articles that you're reading online is referencing it, and then it appears via Amazon in your at your home, at your door, and you're like, where did this come from? And my wife says, oh yeah, I sound like I ordered this. Okay, great. Wonderful. So we had the opportunity to sort of work through at least some of it together. And that's exactly how we landed on this. This is by no means saying that this is the exclusive approbation, rabbinic approbation for all of the entire genre out there. But I think that particularly when it comes to this book, and again, I would strongly, strongly recommend it. I'll try to send out a link, Amir Tashem, so everybody could order their own copy if you so desire and if you so choose. But when it comes to this book in particular, I think that what is so resonant about it is that there are not too many chidushin, much in the same way that Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato sort of outlines Maseilas Yesharim. He says, you know, you're not really going to find that this is like jam-packed with novel ideas and novel thoughts. They're just things that I think deeply resonate, maybe in terms of approach and maybe in terms of framing of any of these individual ideas, yes. But I think that these are the kinds of things that we would anticipate being part of the recipe of a good and successful and properly working marriage. So with those points of introduction, let's really get going here. And I referenced this already, but I think it's just interesting to note that the term that we use when it comes to the idea of building, not really just a home, yes, but it seems to be the term that's used specifically when we speak about marriage, is, you know, you should build a bayis ne'eman b'Yisrael. Should build a home that is, how do you define it, ne'eman. It's more than trustworthy, it's what it ought to do. It's tried and true. And it's the concept of building. And I think that that's very critical when we think about marriage, and again, why we're all in this room. That marriage is not just something that we can manage. It's not just the sort of thing that, like, I did it already, I took care of it. We manage when it comes to a car. And we manage when it comes to taking out the trash. And we manage when it comes to so many dimensions of life that we don't really care all that much about. We just need to make sure that we maintain... Didn't go? But we need to make sure that, at least in some areas of life, that things are simply maintained. Nobody sneeze? Nobody breathe? Okay. So for some areas of life, we need to make sure, and certainly when it comes to certain assets, as long as they're sort of kept in check, and as long as they are maintained at the level that they are already at, then that's fine. Because we just need it to fulfill its utilitarian purpose. Right, this is how we think, at least this is how we usually think about cars. Like, it gets me from point A to point B. I don't need to think about much more than that, just that it's basically reliable and dependable. When it comes to the idea of building a home, I think when my Sarah's grandmother first came over, when we were, we moved in, and we were in the house for, like, whatever it was the first Sunday, Sarah's whole family came down, and in comes her grandmother, and she says, you know, we're trying here. Hopefully. Let me know if it goes out. I'm not really looking at it. But she said... Oh. Maybe. Hopefully again. So in she comes and she takes a look around. She says, you know, in 25 years, it'll be exactly the way that you want it. And I think that typically that's the way that we think when it comes to homes. You think about, you know, it's like this constant assessing and reassessing of when we renovate, or when we build the extension, or when we put on the extra wing, or when we, you know, bump out this room or that room, or when we do the extra whatever it is, and we get the extra square footage, so where is it all going to go? And I think that that is a very appropriate sort of metaphor when we think about an actual marriage, meaning it is not just something that we want to keep stagnant, and as long as it's basically working and basically functioning, and basically getting me from point A to point B, so that's good enough. What we want is something that's actually developing and something that's actually growing and something that's really thriving. I apologize about the... All right, we'll see. Okay, so let's get into the actual principles. What I'd like to do tonight, and because this is divided over the course of three different lectures, tonight I'd like to try to tackle the first two of Gottman's principles. And principle number one, this is what he calls anyway, and some of the terminology, certainly his own, but we'll try to delve into each and explain exactly what he means as outlined by the book, and then also hopefully get some background in terms of Torah content and Torah resonance as well. So he calls this enhance your love maps. What exactly does that mean? So here's a brief quote. He says that these couples have made plenty of cognitive room for their marriage. Cognitive room. We're not even in the realm of emotion yet, right? But just cognitive room, meaning that there is an intellectual awareness of where the other person is. They remember the major events in each other's history, and they keep updating their information as the facts and feelings of their spouse's world change. Again, even though we might be addressing feeling, this is much more of a cognitive, intellectual knowledge of the other person. When she orders him a salad, she knows what kind of dressing he likes. If she works late, he'll think to record her favorite TV show. He could tell you how she's feeling about her boss and exactly how to get to her office from the elevator. They know each other's life goals, worries, and hopes. And this is really something of a smattering of some things that are really much more superficial and then other things that are much more in-depth. But this is a critical point, which basically is that knowledge is power. And I don't mean that in terms of the manipulative sort of sense, but it's a basic fundamental reality that I cannot really appreciate a person, or I cannot really, certainly not really love a person if I don't even know who that person is. It might be true that I coincidentally live in the same house that they do, and it might be that we are even raising children together. It might be that we're actually paying a mortgage together. But if I don't really know who this person is, then how can I profess to love that person? So part of, or at least the first step in getting a framework even for the rest of the relationship to hang on to, is a basic understanding, awareness, knowledge of who this person is, their likes, their dislikes, what they're all about. This is something that is as old as marriage itself. It's interesting that when we speak about knowledge, or when we speak about the idea of intimacy in the Torah, we of course speak about knowledge in the biblical sense. The ha'adam yada es chava ishto, v'atar v'teled es kayin. That this conception, which obviously is in the result of the original act of intimacy, is referred to by the Torah itself as yediyah, because it is impossible to separate those two concepts, those two ideas. The idea that starts off or begins as knowledge, of course, continues in a much deeper capacity beyond just what's your favorite color and what sort of dressing do you want on a salad. But that's where it begins. What we are attempting for and what we're shooting for is to try to really understand and know who exactly the other person is that we're hopefully sharing a life together with. So Gottman says that without such a map, you can't really know your spouse. And if you don't really know someone, then how can you truly love them? So he actually gives, and one of the reasons why I suggest the book and why I recommend it so highly is that at the end of each one of the principles, he has a series of different, I don't know, call them games, call them activities, almost like date nights that you can actually perform and that you can engage in together with your spouse. And there, some are a little bit more challenging, frankly. Some are a little bit more, lighthearted and fun, but really, really worthwhile. So one activity is basically just to sort of go through a laundry list of different questions and try to test yourself. Do I know this about my spouse or not? It's a great place to start. Questions like, what's my favorite color? What's one of my favorite weekend activities? What do I fear the most? What was my worst childhood experience? What would I consider my ideal job? Again, some of these are purely statistical. These are the kinds of things that I might know about anyone, but wouldn't necessarily create a very deep relationship on the one hand. On the other hand, it's hard to say that anything could then develop or continue into a deep relationship if some of even these very, very basic kinds of stats, if you will, aren't first explored and aren't first understood, aren't first known. Again, some of them actually get into much more significant, much deeper kinds of dimensions of a person's identity, which becomes hugely important for really attempting to connect with our spouses. So I think it's critical at this point that we try to frame this a little bit. I think that when it comes to some of these bits of knowledge, perhaps, that we're after, we could very much consider them in the context of, okay, so like I have to pay the bills, meaning that this is another chore or this is another errand, and like, shame on me. But there's a lot here that we can, unfortunately, sort of twist or turn around and think about in a context of shaming myself for not already being there and not already knowing and not already having that information, not already having that knowledge. That would really be very much a shame. The idea here is not just paying the bills. It's not just another errand. It's not just another check that I can mark off and say that, good, I've done it. Now I know. Good, now I know her favorite color, so like everything's fine. Or now I know what his favorite salad dressing is, and now everything's okay, and I've gotten that nugget now. This is buried treasure. I think if we just attempt to try to view our own spouses with a certain measure of curiosity, this is a really intriguing person that I have the privilege and the pleasure of sharing a life with. But there might yet be things that I don't know. That's fascinating to me. That's incredible. That's incredible. The idea that even though we might have lived lives for, who knows, for 10, 20, 30, 40 years side by side, maybe I don't know what their initial childhood professional ambition necessarily was. And the idea that that's still something that can be found out, that's a nugget that can still be explored, that's something that I have right in my backyard and never actually thought to unearth and uncover, I think if we allow ourselves to become filled with curiosity and intrigue and excitement, I think that can be a huge game changer in terms of the way that we even approach one another really in the first place. So the idea here, though, is not simply, and along these lines, thinking of this as buried treasure and trying to unearth what actually is taking place. It's not just like sitting there with a questionnaire, although it is a great place to start, and it could be a lot of fun. And going in with that sort of mentality of, I'm looking for those nuggets of gold that are buried right in my backyard. So it can be a lot of fun, it could be great, but what Gottman recommends really are asking open-ended questions. The kinds of things like, how are you feeling right now about being a parent? The kind of thing that I can't just allow myself to say, good, I checked it, I know it now, favorite salad dressing, favorite color, your youngest sibling's middle name that for some reason or another never came up, or your favorite name, or your least favorite name, or whatever. You probably, you might well know the favorite name, so what's your least favorite name? But some of those open-ended questions, like how are you feeling? How have you developed? How have you evolved in your perspective of different things over the course of your life, over the course of our marriage? If you could pick a different career or vocation, what would it be and why? Sometimes we can become so entrenched in the basic patterns of life that these things never, by the way, sometimes these actually serve as questions that help the spouse themselves start to unearth or start to flesh out that own dimension of their identity. This could also be opening up a Pandora's box. So be careful, everybody. You ask this question, the next thing you know, your spouse is going back to med school. So be very, very careful. Ask only what you really know. But the fact of the matter is that curiosity and that interest and that knowledge, and let's actually think. Let's think together. Let's explore. And I want to know how it is that you actually think about these things. But you can only get there really, really deeply by asking some of those more open-ended questions. If you could design the perfect home for us, what would it be like? What a fascinating point. What an interesting idea. Right? What does that say? And continue the conversation. I think I would, bump out the dining room. Well, what does that say about you? What does that say about us? What does that say about your vision for our family? Does that mean what does that mean about dining room space as compared to bedroom space? What does that mean about your dream that you always shared about how we're going to put in an in-ground pool? What does it mean about the number of guests that we already have? About the number of children that we have? What does it mean about the more formal space as compared to the less formal space or more relaxed kind of space? What does all of that mean? And being able to explore some of those items in conversation. Have any of your life goals recently changed? Not just stats knowledge. We're not just looking for these little data points. We're looking to actually know one another, much the same way that the Torah describes Adam ultimately knew Chava, because that's what intimacy is really all about. And of course, I hope this goes without saying, but of course it is completely possible, it's completely feasible to have this completely warped. And this is what's so challenging, I think, very much about the society that we live in today, that everything has sort of been upended and everything is on its head and so much has become topsy-turvy. That we think about a straight line going from some of these data points, like these are like dating questions, right? How many siblings do you have, and what's your favorite color, and what's your favorite one that I like to do? What's your favorite bridge? What's your favorite bridge? You can learn a lot about a person. What's your favorite bridge? Brooklyn Bridge? Do you like history? Verrazano? Do you like length? Do you like span? Do you more modern architecture? Learn a lot about a person. What's their favorite bridge? But did I ever ask you this? Never. What's your favorite bridge? So, but the point is that we move from those data points to a relationship that becomes more and more and more deep and intimate until it's actually consummated. That's what the Torah describes. Where we live today, in the way that we live today, look around, is that what we call the deepest level of intimacy sometimes comes first. It never even occurred to me to ask you what your favorite color was. After all, I've only known you for 6 hours. And yet, we're already living like Adam and Chava. Or we've already had that sort of relationship like Adam and Chava. It's completely upended. It's completely topsy-turvy. But where it begins for us is with knowledge, and it becomes deeper and deeper and deeper until it actually completely it hits that crescendo and that apex in the full-blown the system of marriage that we know. But knowledge needs to be constant. Knowledge needs to be kept up with, because the fact of the matter is people change and life circumstances change, and we want to know where our spouses are with respect to everything that's taken place. I sort of alluded to this already, but in no small part, this also becomes a question of who I am. Of who I am. And this is something that I think we also need to try to develop a little bit. And it comes more easily to some than to others. But what are my own personal triumphs and strivings? Why are these things important? Why do I need to know what my own interests are? You know, effectively it becomes surface area. If I am a very narrow person, if I am a very one-dimensional person, there are only so many areas now for my spouse to attach to. If I'm multifaceted, it doesn't mean that I have to be a Renaissance man. It doesn't mean that I have to to develop other ideas and hobbies. But it just means to be a thinking person. To be a thinking person about the world that I'm engaged in, what does it mean to me, and these things are happening, to be somewhat self-reflective so that we're capable of actually allowing our spouses in. If we are one-dimensional, there's not much surface area for our spouses to stick to. If we are multifaceted, then there are so many dimensions to be able to connect with our spouses. What are my own personal triumphs and strivings? I'm trying to find out what my spouses are, but what are mine to be able to allow her or him into my own world? What does my emotional world look like? Who do I want to become? Gottman has some great, he has like a great game or conversation about touching on each one of these topics and more. But the idea is that it can't just be a willingness to inquire. It also has to be a willingness to share. And this is really, at least for many, for some more than others, I might be able to tell you that from personal experience, that the ability to inquire is actually easier than the ability to share. We're all made differently. Some people are open books and some people are very private. Some people are introverts and some people are extroverts. Some people don't mind, you know, spilling the beans and letting everybody, the entire world, know everything that's on my mind, whether we want to know or not. And some people are much more reticent to just, are much more tight-lipped about what's going on in their lives. But the ability to sort of find out, first of all, firsthand, who am I, and then also being able to open up and actually share it, that is a tremendous act of giving. It's not just a matter of inquiring, how was your day, but also sharing, my day was this way. Because if I don't share how my day was, or if I don't share how I'm feeling, or I just want to sort of bottle up, I don't want to share that frustration, I don't want to share that pain, I don't want to share that I'm anxious, I don't want to share that I'm frustrated, I don't want to share any of these things, I'd rather just keep it inside, either because it's my own personal makeup, or because I don't want to bother my spouse, I don't want to encumber my spouse. These are all opportunities, and these all become sort of those sticking points, those different dimensions of our personality that our spouses can actually stick to. So part of that glue that's going to hold this together is not just knowing who my spouse is, but knowing who I am and allowing myself or bringing myself to actually share that with my spouse so they can connect back to me as well. The importance of da'as cannot be understated. Indeed, this becomes the very first item that we actually request. Atachonen la'adam da'as. Very first request, very first bakasha in all of Shemona Esrei. We have a lot in our minds. There's a lot that we need. There's a lot that we require. But if having that back and forth with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, if being able to seek out Hashem and say that I need this, that, and the other thing, I need health, and I need wealth, I need parnasa, and I need a new pair of shoes, if I want to be able to do all of those things, then first and foremost, it has to begin with Da'as. I need to be able to know. I need to be able to understand. I need to be able to understand Hashem. The very first item in our development of our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Da'as. That's where it all begins. You bestow knowledge upon mankind to teach understanding to human beings. Grace us with knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. And there are many parallels. I think if we reflect a little bit upon Shir HaShirim, the idea or the parallel that exists between the relationship that we are meant to have with our spouse and the relationship that we are meant to have with Hashem, working in both directions, trying to leverage one for the sake of the other, or leverage one for the sake of greater, better understanding the other, becomes a critically important point for ourselves as Klal Yisrael. Principle one, questions, thoughts, ideas, comments. Okay, let's keep going. Please feel free to jump in at any point, but also make sure to try to save some time if anybody wants to discuss more at the end. Principle two. Principle two is what Gottman calls nurture your fondness and admiration. Nurture your fondness and admiration. So, he does not give this mashal, but I think it's a very important, and I think it's a very fair sort of metaphor in examining the relationship between these two first principles. Principle one, if it's the idea of enhancing your love maps, it's about das. It's about knowledge. Think of that as the actual, it's the housing, it's the casing, it's the more than just the framework perhaps, but it's sort of like the home itself. But it is a completely bare, barren, empty home. The framework is there. I can recognize it now. It's impossible to begin to love somebody if you don't even know who they are. Now I know who you are, but I can still, of course, make the decision that I'm going to walk away, or that I'm not going to engage, or that I'm not going to try to do whatever needs to be done in order to enhance the degree of what we would usually call love, friendship, camaraderie, fondness, affection, admiration, ava, call it what you will. That is effectively the furnishing that goes into the home, so that it becomes livable, so that it becomes a place that we want to return to. It could be a beautiful home on the outside. Nobody wants to go home at night if there isn't a couch to sit on, if there's no table to eat at, and if there's no bed to sleep in. So these become the kinds of furnishings that we can actually present, or we can actually furnish our marriage with, to be able to flesh out the interior and make it a place of warmth, make it a place that we really genuinely want to be. So what's the inverse? The inverse is contempt. The inverse is contempt. Contempt is what, and I skipped over this part, again, I would strongly recommend the book, but as far as I was concerned, I think this was actually placed somewhat out of order. But John Gottman, a word on Gottman and his research. Where is he coming from? So what makes Gottman unusual and interesting and compelling as well is that is his love lab. That sound great? Isn't that like really hokey sounding? The love lab is what he calls his research center. His research center doesn't look like a regular lab. It's basically an apartment in Seattle where, this is going to sound terrible, where he videotapes couples. Let me explain. Where he invites people in to basically interact with one another, and not even necessarily for counseling, although that's part of it, but in part just to be filmed, in part going through their daily grind. So meaning you come to the love lab and you basically move in for a weekend, and you go about your regular business. You have breakfast together, you have lunch together, you read the morning paper together, or you read the morning paper apart, or you eat breakfast apart, or you whatever it is. But meaning you go through the daily grind, and he's videotaping all this, and then also getting some on-camera actual sort of interviewing. And what this has allowed him to do in these longitudinal studies, keeping up with these couples over years and then even decades, is that it's given him the ability to assess, when we saw this in just this brief moment, and maybe we saw it again and again, or we started seeing it as a pattern with this couple, where did they end up over the long haul, both for the good and also for the bad? And over the course of these years and decades of study and of research and analysis, what he developed is what he calls the four horsemen of the apocalypse. There are four, call them what you will, midos, magunos, there are four traits that can creep or crawl their way into the patterns of a marriage that spell, not certain, but spell likely disaster and likely peril. One of which is contempt. So the way that he defines contempt, or the way that he often sees contempt, is this sort of like snarl or eye roll. This doesn't mean, I hope, this doesn't mean that if you've ever rolled your eyes at anyone, that that means that you hold them in absolute contempt and that you're a contemptuous person or anything of the sort. But this is the sort of thing that we need to be able to keep in check. Fondness and admiration is the antithesis of contempt. Holding somebody in contempt means that I don't think anything of you. I don't respect you as a person, as a human being, certainly not as a spouse. When this creeps into a marriage and into a relationship, it is highly, highly compromising and highly difficult to get. It doesn't mean that it can't be, but this is one of the different items that we want to be very careful about not allowing ourselves to slip into, certainly not as a pattern, certainly not as a matter of course, that any time a spouse, or anybody for that matter, but that if every time, we'll put it this way, if every time somebody, whoever that somebody is, offers a suggestion or makes a suggestion, it's met with, whether spoken or unspoken, that is the stupidest idea I've ever heard in my entire life, and it figures. It figures because it came from you. That's basically what is bound up in an eye roll, effectively. Here you go again. Preach, 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 preach. Good, yeah, okay, right. Let's hear all the brilliant ideas. So that is effectively what is taking place in our brains while we are rolling our eyes and making this snarl, that little, when the lip curls up, that's what's going on. If that becomes a matter of course, if that becomes a pattern, then we're in a very, very bad place. What is the opposite? So let's talk about the positive. What is the opposite? The opposite is fondness and admiration. And here is another critical point as we compare ourselves to the way, that society tends to function. There is a lot of thought, how is it that two people fall in love? How is it that two people fall in love? So the Jewish answer, and I know that this is a cliche, but it is totally true, completely true. The answer is that there's no such thing. You don't fall in love. You don't fall in love. You can fall in lust. You can fall in. You can fall head over heels. You can fall into a state of infatuation. But if fundamentally what love means, first and foremost, what a relationship means, is that I know who this person is so that I can make a fair assessment as to whether or not I want to actually connect with them and get to know them and be with them and give to them, so then it is impossible to just fall into that state haphazardly and accidentally. And this is a huge, huge point for marriage, but really all of relationships. Rav Dessler really develops this point a lot, and we'll probably get there in coming lectures, not so much this one. But a very important point made by Chazal in a lesser-known Masechta, in Derech Eretz Zuta. Im chafetzata lidovek ba'avas chaverecha heve nosei v'nosein b'tovasa. That if you want to cling to somebody with love, then what you should do is you should endeavor, you should nosei v'nosein b'tovasa. It either means that you should actually engage and speak, or it might actually mean a matter of engaging with them directly, but you engage with them for their good. You try to benefit them, because it's something that can be developed. We say this all throughout character development, all throughout the development of our midos, throughout the Sifrei Musar, Adam Nif'al Kafi Pu'ulosav, that a person is actually formed and forged based on his actions. We typically think that the way we act, we are going to act as a function of the way that we feel. That can be true, but the inverse is also true. We can actually begin to feel the way that we act. There have been studies that indicate that when you do so much as smile, force a smile, you actually come to appreciate the joke that much more. Or you come to create a much more positive association with whatever it is that you're looking at while you're wearing that fake, phony, plastered smile. I don't know if they still do this. There used to be a laugh track. They still have this? It's like, it's still a thing? Yeah? Right? Filmed in front of a live studio audience. Why bother? Like, it's the most absurd thing in the world. I'm watching a show at home in my living room, and something takes place on the screen, and everybody, like, in the background is laughing. It's an absurd kind of idea. But why do they keep on doing it? Because it makes you laugh. Because you feel like a fool if you're laughing by yourself. Nobody laughs by themselves, because it's not, even though nobody else is here, I'm self-conscious. How do I know that it's really funny? I need somebody to give me permission that I'm allowed to laugh because they're telling me that this is supposed to be funny, and then I don't feel like I'm totally out of place when I actually laugh. We are affected not only by our environment, but even just the very small gestures that we make and the small actions that we do. Love is something unequivocally that can be developed if we go into it with that mentality. We might fall into good feelings. We might fall into warmth. We might fall into romance. That's all perhaps a great starting point. But if we don't develop it intentionally and consciously, unfortunately we can fall out just as quickly as we fell in, because it's only skin deep. Absolutely beautiful insight from Rav Hirsch. Rav Hirsch equates the word ahava with hav. Hav is really an Aramaic word, but it comes from the same root. It's the same, they're cognates and they're sister languages of one another, which means to give. Ahava is to give. with a prefixed aleph, meaning when you add on the aleph referring to the active personality, means both now to give oneself up to another and to seek to draw the other exceedingly close to oneself. And they go hand in hand. It cannot be any other way. If I don't give to the other person, we'll get into this more in the coming principles and in the coming lectures, but the primary point is that this is something that we can work on. It's something that can be developed. Just because fondness isn't always there doesn't mean that we can't become expert in it. Just because admiration, honor, respect isn't always there doesn't mean it's something that cannot be developed. Indeed, it very much can. That is to strive to attain a most intimate association with someone, and this happens as a function of our giving, our interest, whether we feel like it or not. We're not in the mood, suddenly get in the mood. And when we do it, it actually changes things. By the way, the reverse is also true, which I just think is absolutely fascinating. The opposite of ahav is sane, right, which means hatred, related to sne. What's the sne? The thistle bush, right? The burning bush, little thicket, little thorn bush. Meaning essentially to be a thorn, to fend off the other and keep him as far away from oneself as possible. How do I do that? By being a taker instead of a giver, or just being parav. Just being parav. When I give, I naturally become closer to that person becomes closer to me. But if I just take, or if I fend off, and if I don't allow for that giving relationship, then there's no way for that ava to actually develop. So how do we think about this, and how do we actually go about doing this? So we need to think both of the past and also the present in considering how to develop fondness, meaning to sort of resuscitate the fondness that was already there, which needs to then be rediscovered perhaps, but then also in the present and in the moment to actually find new ways to be able to do so. Absolutely amazing mashal, Moshe, thank you for this, which is the campfire or the fireplace. So when we think of the past, what we need to realize is that the recipe for success is already there. Meaning we've already been through this before. If we have ended up, in all likelihood, unless there was some really crazy weekend in Vegas, if we have already ended up in a marriage, it is by, I don't mean Chol HaMoed or Yom Tov in Vegas, that's a different situation. But if we are here and it was with some measure of intention, that means that at some point we got to know this person. And at some point there were things that I found remarkable about this person. And I was inspired by this person. And I was impressed by this person. And I had a great time with this person, because otherwise I wouldn't be here. So if I'm here now, and we've had all those experiences, and I've had all those thoughts, and I've had all those feelings, and why can't I simply uncover all of those past emotions, all of those past experiences, in order to get things going? And the idea is that when it comes to this fire, those embers are already there, they're already glowing. How do you get it going? Again, you gotta stoke them. You gotta stoke them. And I think the other dimension of this mashal is also beautiful, which is that if you just take a log and you just drop it, it doesn't work. That doesn't fan the flames. That suffocates the flames. So often we think, I need a supercharge. I need a supercharge to get me going. This could be about magic. It could be about anything. I need some amazing retreat. I need that weekend in Vegas. Whatever it is. You know, let's go on vacation to Barbados for a week, and that's just going to recreate everything, and it's going to give us like the romantic getaway, and everything is going to be incredible. The problem is that you get there, you have nothing to talk about. And you get there and you don't want to have a conversation. And what Gottman talks about is that true romance is found so much more in those small little conversations that you can have over a cup of coffee in your own kitchen, so much more than those big, highfalutin, flashy kinds of getaways. That can actually be something that just, it almost suffocates the flames. And there's one more dimension. It's like, you know, this is like the Dubin HaMagid, like everything has a different. I think also the idea of stoking, the idea of stoking is so important. You got to poke and you got to prod. It could be uncomfortable. It could be uncomfortable. But the payoff is huge. Meaning it doesn't mean that everything is going to go swimmingly. And it doesn't mean that everybody wants to open up right away. And it doesn't mean that I'm going to want to share, that you're going to want to share. And it doesn't mean that it's not going to feel hokey at the beginning when we say, let's look at our wedding album. Let's dust off the, look at our wedding. What are you talking, like, what? I'm writing a show. We have a car payment. I'm helping with home. What are you talking about? We haven't looked at our, I don't even know where our wedding album is. It's, I don't know, It's next to the tsuba. Hopefully we know where it is. But let's reminisce about dating life. It can feel very hokey initially if you're not in the practice of actually doing this. But think about what it does. It opens up this whole conversation, this whole period in our lives when we decided, when did you know? When did you know? What was it? When did you know that I was the person that you wanted to spend the rest of your life with? And vice versa. It could be uncomfortable. It's very vulnerable. But we've already been there. I think remembering that we're already there and remembering that those embers are still glowing and are still blazing brightly, they might be very small, but they can actually be absolutely be stoked and be prodded into an enormous, enormous fire. Shared trips, experiences. Let's pull off some of those albums. Let's take a look, right? The first trip that we ever took, it was so nice. It was so special. Why don't we do that again? And maybe that becomes an important conversation. I don't want to do it again. Well, why not? What changed? What happened? I don't know. I'm just not in that place anymore. Good. Let's talk about it. But the knowledge that we've already been here before and that we've already been capable of that before, you and me as people, I think is a very empowering bit of knowledge to be aware of. There's also the present. There's also the present. The present is about, this is at least a suggestion, taking note and leaving notes. Taking note and leaving notes is that there are myriad ways that we give to one another over the course of an average day in the life of a regular, typical marriage. The problem is that we have gotten so accustomed to all of those things that it is difficult to really take stock of. So this can happen in any relationship. This can certainly happen in our relationship with Hashem. So Hashem and Chazal outsmarted us. They said, you got to daven 3 times a day. Well, what am I supposed to do? You know, like, I don't have anything to say to you right now. Well, too bad. You have to say these things. So no matter how annoyed and no matter how frustrated and no matter how bad life has gotten, no matter how apathetic I may have become, these are the things that I need to say. What do they remind us of? They remind us of some of the most basic features and functions. Birchos HaShachar, I wake up in the morning, I say Zokev Kufuf, and I was able to get out of bed. Just that I was able to I had like back pain this week. And we both sort of said, like, okay, I caught it from you. Yeah, contagious. Yeah, I had back trouble this week. And like, so what do you remember? You remember, wow, I have a back. I have a back, remarkable, right? It goes away after 24 hours, and 24 hours and two or three will leave later, and like, you're back in business. And it's an amazing thing, I have a back. And every single day, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives me a back. And every single day, my Mechin Mitzadei Gavar, and my feet are working one after the other, after the other, after the other. And it's incredible. But we can so easily lose stock of it, and we can certainly lose stock of it in our marriage. We give to one another, even if we don't like one another, Chas v'Shalom, but we still give to one another in myriad ways. And if we remind ourselves of that, if we take note, I tell myself that I'm going to leave a note today. I'm going to say thank you. And again, it's the stoking. It's the stoking. Is my spouse going to look at me like, what is this? This is not you. Okay, it's me now. Trying to make it me. I want this to be me. This is the version of me that I want to be. So, you're welcome, by the way. but I'm going to leave a note today. For this week, every day, there's going to be a note on the pillow. There's going to be a note on the kitchen counter in the morning. So my spouse comes downstairs and they're going to see it. They're going to see, so what's it? So now I have to look. Now I have to look. Now I have to be on the lookout for things. And when we're on the lookout, and when it becomes almost mandated, and again, it feels forced, it is to some degree, but this rebuilds all that muscle memory. Those kinds of things that perhaps came so easily when we were in that infatuation stage, which we believed was love, but believe me, it wasn't. It wasn't yet. It wasn't yet. I think somebody... One of my kids, I don't know, I think one of my kids asked me this recently, who loves each other more, like you and mommy, or like grandma and grandpa? It's like, for sure, grandma and grandpa. It's got to be. Why? I hope so. It's got to be. Why? Because I would expect that by the time that we're there, right, that love has developed. Chas v'shalom, I wouldn't want to think that just end up in the exact same place. It's developed over time. There's a little bit of a corollary to this. This might be a little bit more controversial. I think the same is actually true of kids. I think it takes a while for kids to like catch up. The idea that like I love the newborn as much as like a child that I've already known for 5 years. I'm not sure. I have a hard time, at least for fathers. At least for fathers. We could talk about that later, but I think it's true. They catch up pretty quickly, but I think it's true. But the idea is that these are things that develop. It doesn't happen haphazardly. It's not something that's accidental. It's not something that is just an emotional sort of feeling, like the sense that you have in your gut. Butterflies in my stomach, I'm in love. That's so sad. That's so sad. Love is something that can be nurtured. And when we tell ourselves that we are going to nurture it in certain ways, even if it feels like we're poking and prodding, and maybe even reaching a little bit too far in the initial stages, in the initial days, it pays dividends in the long run. We need to become the kind of people for whom, yes, taking note, taking stock is almost mandated. Personally mandated. This is what I'm taking on. This is my Kabbalah. I want to make sure that at some point over the course of my life, I don't completely forget about the fact that when you cook dinner, it's like, you know, just whatever, it's just another thing. Or that I took out the garbage and like nobody noticed. Or that I was caring, I was sweet, I was sensitive, I made a point, I went out of my way, I tried to do this, and nobody notices anymore. God forbid. So there's something very powerful about the post-it, about the desire, the interest, and the determination, the commitment that I'm going to leave a note. It forces me to take note. This can happen in myriad ways. There's so many different ways that we can almost mandate for ourselves personally in our lives. We can turn this into, see, Moshe's got a very elaborate and great game, that 21-day game, right? Amazing, amazing game. He can take this on as a Kabbalah, as a couple together. He could do it personally. There are different ways to go about doing it, but I think that more than just trying to fan the flames of, oh yeah, back in the past, we used to, when it used to be that way, but now, well, unfortunately not. There's one more item that, unfortunately, I forgot to actually include in the slides, but I think is really critical, and it goes along with this principle and this idea, and that's going to take us, I think, to the end here. Just about. Which is as follows. What about the following? So it's great. It's great to think about fondness and admiration, and we recognize, and I so appreciate that you did this, that, and the other thing. But the fact of the matter is, he does a million things that bother me. The fact of the matter is, she's really annoying. You did all of these at the end. This was good, and that was nice, and that was... Yeah, but you're also lazy and stingy and annoying and frustrating and whatever it is, and this, that, and the other thing. So what do we do about that reality? The reality is that we are not perfect, and the reality is that we are far from perfect, and it is likely that our spouse has picked up on just how imperfect we are, probably even better than we have ourselves. So now what? So listen to the following. So this comes from a great book, and this is another highly recommended book called Deep Work by Cal Newport. It's a totally different approach, but there's some very important overlap here. The book is basically a treatise on the importance of Zitzfleisch and Kavana. Basically training ourselves to work deeply, to focus deeply, and to not just work superficially, which unfortunately is so much of the way that we actually work today because of very quick emails and very quick sound bites and very quick little errands that are all just take place in just a nanosecond. So he says as follows, and he speaks about actually the research of somebody else, somebody named Winifred Gallagher. But he says as follows: this concept upends the way most people think about their subjective experience of life. We tend to place a lot of emphasis on our circumstances, assuming that what happens to us or fails to happen determines how we feel. From this perspective, the small-scale details of how you spend your day aren't that important, because what matters are the large-scale outcomes, such as whether or not you get a promotion or move to that nicer apartment. Decades of research contradict this understanding. Our brains instead construct our worldview based on what we pay attention to. If you focus on a cancer diagnosis, you and your life become unhappy and dark. But if you focus instead on an evening martini, you and your life become more pleasant, even though the circumstances in both scenarios are the same. Who you are, what you think, feel, and do, what you love, is the sum of what you focus on. Put in other words, Ezehu Ashir Hasameach Bechelko. When Chazal say that the key to happiness is being pleased with and satisfied with your lot, they are not suggesting that everybody's lot is equally objectively good and that there are no blemishes. There always are. The question is, what do we focus on? What do we become content with? The idea of whether taking note and leaving notes and fanning the flames and fondness and admiration is that
those things exist also. Undoubtedly, there are lots of good qualities and lots of favors and lots of goodness that we are doing for one another. The question is, what do we choose to focus on and what do we choose to ignore? When we choose to focus on the good and the goodness and the fondness and the admiration, so much of which is already existing, so much of which is already latent in the relationship itself, not only does that strengthen the relationship, but we become happier and more optimistic and more positive people ourselves. We become a lot more pleasant to be married to in the first place. So the importance of hitting refresh, the importance of reviewing, the importance of reminding ourselves that all of those things that are already there, actually taking stock of, we have in a very, very well-known Rashi in Parshas Kisavo. Pasuk says, "Ayom azeh Hashem lokecha mitzavecha la'asos es achukim ha'ilav es ha'mishpatim." Today, Hashem commands you to keep all the mitzvos, keep all the laws, keep all the statutes. V'shamar tov asitzu, you should observe, you should do osam. V'chol vavecha v'chol nafshecha. With all of your heart and with all of your soul. Meaning what I want, says Hashem, is not just a rote religious existence, is not just a rote spiritual identity, that it's just same old, and I've really gotten accustomed to it, and I've really become habituated into keeping all the mitzvos and doing all the halachos, and I got it, and I'm an expert, and I can do it rather easily now. But I want your lev, and I want your nefesh. I want you all in. In other words, I want a relationship, says Hashem. I want the mitzvahs to be things that actually connect you to me. So how are you supposed to do that? Key is right here in this pasuk. Rashi quotes, Medrash Tanchuma actually, "Bechol yom yihyu ve'einecha chadashim." Every single day you have to view it. Meaning, why is it hayom hazeh, this very day? Because each and every day you have to view it as though they're new, as though they're fresh, as though they were just given today. Ki'ilu bo bayom nitztavesa aleihem. As though it just happened today. A minute of reflection. Half a minute of reflection. 5 seconds of reflection, just to remind ourselves that, like, I'm not just lighting the same Shabbos candles that I lit last week. These are Shabbos candles. I'm bringing Shabbos into my home. I'm filling my home with light. This isn't just the same pair of tefillin that I put on yesterday and I put on the day before and I've been putting on every day since my bar mitzvah. It's just tefillin. It's just tefillin. I'm binding parshios of the Torah. I'm binding das elyon to my arm, opposite my heart, to my brain, to my mind. 5 seconds of reflection is key. When we view them as fresh, when we view them as new, when we view them as novel, it changes everything. It might not change the way that we actually perform, but it changes our perspective, and it makes everything that much sweeter, and really makes everything that much deeper. So what is true, again, like Shira Shirin tells us, what's true of our relationship with our spouses is true of our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What's true of our relationship with Hashem is true of our relationship with our spouses. If the way that Hashem tells us that we connect to Him in a meaningful way, the chol lev of chol nefesh, with our whole hearts and our whole souls, to be all in, is by hitting the refresh button, reminding ourselves that these are important, that I'm going to look at it as being new and fresh and novel every single day. I think we'd be certainly very well served to do the same when it comes to our spouses. And that is the second principle. So at least, we're a third in, more or less. Hatzlacha Rav, everybody. I would more than recommend actually getting this book and flipping through it, certainly if you want to sort of stay on track with the lectures as we go, checking out the first two principles, dipping into the introduction, doing some of these exercises, spending some time, but I hope you found it worthwhile. Questions? Ideas? What am I thinking? This is so not the kind of thing that anybody is going to... I have a question about this person sitting right next to me. If you could just tell it. One other note of apology, just in terms of the way that we actually set up. I hope everybody's comfortable. I did want everybody to be at a table, really, for two reasons. Number one, so you could have something to take notes on and write on, but also because I thought it'd be very, very worthwhile to be able to kick each other under the table, specifically for this this evening, every time you come across it. I told you you were supposed to be there. But anyway, I hope this was a pleasant enough experience, and please feel free to be in touch, and I hope you'll join us for the other installment.